Probably for most people, I don't really need to introduce the speaker. Dave Lowe worked at Greta Point and worked at NIWA and DSIR before that for many years, and he's had a role as really one of the, I'd say, world leaders in trace gas measurement and radiative forcing, greenhouse gas forcing of the atmosphere and so on. Dave left NIWA getting on for a couple of years ago now and started his own company. He's now a director of Low NZ Limited, and also adjunct professor at the Antarctic Research Centre at Victoria University. And he's got a very varied career and lifestyle going on, I think, now, doing all sorts of fascinating things and interacting with all manner of really interesting people and groups. And personally, I've got to know Dave really well, largely through the IPCC process, as well as just knowing him as a colleague here at NIWA. And I've always found Dave to be a really, well, inspirational guy, actually. I think he's just a top person and fabulous scientist. So anyway, I won't rave on too much longer. I'll just hand over to Dave, and all yours. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Thanks for organising this. It really is a very nice feeling to be back here and just see so many friends and workmates. And the other thing that was just, I came here as I usually used to, on my bike, using the train from Plymouth and the bike, and it's just a fabulous ride around here. And sitting in that cafeteria, it's amazing that any work's done here at all. It's really is a super sight, so very nice to be here. The talk that I'm going to give you, there's not going to be a huge amount of science in it, and basically there are four very disparate threads that I'm going to try and stitch together. So I'll start off talking a little bit about the atmosphere, how it's changing, and in particular talk about ozone depletion, because I think there's something there that really tells us about where we're headed with global climate change and some lessons there. The personal change that I made, why I did that, and I'm going to pick out in particular one of the main projects that I've done, which was working with Gareth Morgan, of all people, helping him with the research he needed to write a book on climate change called Poles Apart. Then I want to finish off looking at what I would call a message of hope and the role of renewable energy and just simply other ways of living and other ways of doing things, which I see as an answer, or one of the major answers to climate change. So my story really starts off with this remarkable man, Dave Keeling. Dave Keeling in the 1950s started the first continuous atmospheric carbon dioxide measurements on a mountaintop in Hawaii called Mauna Loa. And his idea for going to Mauna Loa was simply to go to a background part of the atmosphere and just see what was happening with carbon dioxide. And at this stage, no one really knew what they would expect. And it was quite remarkable that within just a couple of years, he made two dramatic discoveries. Now, one of those properties of the atmosphere of carbon dioxide that he discovered is completely natural, and it's the seasonal cycle here. And the other thing, which is this insidious rise here, is absolutely not natural. And so the natural cycles that he found are effectively the planet breathing. It's carbon dioxide, respiration in the fall, the autumn in the northern hemisphere, and then the very rapid uptake of carbon dioxide in the northern hemisphere spring, bringing it down. So here's the planet breathing, if you like. And this process has been going on for millennia. On top of that is this rise of carbon dioxide, which is due, we know now, to the combustion of fossil fuels as well as land clearing. And here are the measurements which are made by NIWA and Blue. You can see essentially what you're talking about here over this 30-odd year period is exponential growth. So this is something that humans have done to the atmosphere. And that growth rate we now know is continuing at a rate of something like 2 to 3% per year, or 2 ppm per year in carbon dioxide. So, just two concepts about the Earth system, and then I'll move on. The first thing is that the planet that we live on is very definitely interactive. And consider that there are three very large reservoirs, the atmosphere, the oceans, and the terrestrial biosphere, which contains all the plants and animals, and trees, and soils. And there are large quantities of substances, natural cycles, which cycle naturally through the system, and they have done for millions of years. That includes carbon. It turns out that due to what's known as net primary productivity, we have around about 50 gigatons of carbon going backwards and forwards every year between the atmosphere and the terrestrial biosphere. Humans are now adding to that at the rate of over 10 gigatons of carbon. So you can see we are a very, very significant player in this enormous interactive system, the Earth-atmosphere system. So that's the first concept, and the next concept, this is LoNZ's website, and one of the things I've got on here is what you might call the thin film. This is a shot from space of the atmosphere, and this is probably well over 100 kilometres out, but the dramatic thing you see here, the curvature of the Earth, is just how fragile the atmosphere is. And so it's absolutely a no-brainer that if we're pumping that amount of carbon dioxide, as well as other gases, into the atmosphere, we're going to change both the physical and chemical properties of the atmosphere. Okay, let's have a look at stratospheric ozone depletion. Now, this story, I think if you hadn't heard of it before, you'd think, what a remarkable plot for a novel, because it really is stranger than fiction, and just the sheer stupidity and also the remarkable luck that we have to survive this thing. It really is, I'd call it the tale of the folly and fortunes of humans. So the story starts with this guy, Thomas Midgley, who at the turn of last century was a kind of an eccentric American inventor. And he was employed by a company called DuPont, a very large chemical company in the US. And the first gift that he gave to humans was leaded petrol, tetraethyl lead, which, as you probably know, resulted in the premature deaths of millions of people, particularly children. But not only that, he also gave us CFCs, the same guy. And what happened was, back in the early part of last century, refrigerants were very nasty substances like sulfur dioxide and ammonia. And if you had one of these things blow up in your house, you were dead. And so it was essential to find a new refrigerant. And so Thomas Midgley was given the task, and he came up with CFCs, which are substituted methane molecules. What you do is you strip all the hydrogens off and you add fluorine and chlorine. This particular one here, F12, which is one of the most damaging ones, has two chlorines and two fluorines on it. So what happened? Well, it wasn't... These things were called the wonder chemicals, and they were made millions of tons of them every year. And it wasn't really until the 1970s that people started suggesting, hey, CFCs and also... a fleet of jet aircraft in the stratosphere, we could have problems with ozone depletion, because both nitric oxide, which you get from jet aircraft exhaust, and chlorine from CFCs can result in ozone depletion. So people looked, and nothing was found, and they did some calculations, and they figured, oh, well, there's not really a problem. The crazy thing was that the evidence was there, but it was completely overlooked. And this is what happened. Essentially, in the mid-1980s, British scientists had been making measurements using total column instruments in the Antarctic for many, many years, and they'd noticed this odd dip in their measurements in total column ozone in the springtime, the Antarctic springtime. they couldn't understand the data, so they just put it on the back burner and didn't do anything about it. The same observations were made from US satellites, basically the same remarkable dip, but they actually went one further than the British. They actually figured that the instruments were malfunctioning and they wrote a computer program to ignore the data. So it was really sheer serendipity that some of these people were at the same meeting and they started talking to each other and they figured that there was a problem. So ozone depletion over 20 years in the Antarctic, dramatic drop, and at the same time the size of the ozone hole increased to more than the size of the whole of North America. So that's Mexico, Canada and the US combined. Huge area. So a very serious problem. In the 1980s there was a protocol called the Montreal Protocol drawn up between the OECD countries mostly, and this included New Zealand, and further factories making CFCs were banned. And it was a very interesting protocol because although there were severe penalties, these never really had to be invoked because no country broke this ban. And so what happened was DuPont, which was the major company making CFCs, protested and suddenly overnight they changed and they said, oh yeah, we've got a serious problem, and of course you have to be cynical. Well, what happened was they found that they could make even more money out of making the substitutes for the CFCs. Well, that's the way human ingenuity works. Whatever happened here, measurements of CFCs in the troposphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, you can see that they're dropping. So here's the thing, provided we stick to this ban and don't produce more CFCs, within around about, it's estimated, 30 to 40 years, the ozone layer will recover. It will take a long time because the lifetime of these species in the stratosphere is very, very long. But this is a success story. And so if you look at it and figure out, well, what happened? Well, the scientists provided a very clear warning once they figured out it wasn't a good idea to ignore data. The special interests, and this included the DuPont company, they were really heckling the scientists for years. And you'd have a meeting like this, and there'd be someone from DuPont at the back heckling, and that's a pretty tough situation. That actually happened for many years, but then they developed HCFCs, the substitute chemicals. Media were brilliant, public concern was very, very clear, and the result was that no more of these factories have been built, at least in OECD countries. So what about the global warming story? Well, the first thing about global warming, if you think ozone depletion is complicated, it's actually trivial compared to what's going on with global warming, which is an enormously complex issue. And it would be true to say that there is no expert anywhere on the planet who fully understands all of the implications of global warming, let alone all of the science. And that's why the IPCC gets together literally hundreds of experts from different fields of science and then collates and assesses all of this information. They have to do that. And one of the issues there is that you can get terribly bogged down in details. It's very, very hard, and scientists argue with each other, they're human. So that it's like walking through treacle. If you thought the special interests were bad with ozone depletion, they're really bad with global climate change. There is an emphasis on short-term profits. People really don't look towards the future. And oddly enough, I think that one of the issues, at least with the kind of democratic systems we have in the West, is election terms are very short. And no politician in a Western country is really going to put it all on the line for something like global warming, which seems so far in the future. Media, you've seen this. You look at the newspaper and someone from Auckland, who I won't name, will come out with a full-page spread on how global climate change is a lot of nonsense. the public, gosh, you know, people I've talked to are understandably confused. Really, you don't know what's going on. Governments, and this includes our own governments, the previous Labor government and this one, there is actually a lot of rhetoric there. There's no clear leadership, and there's a kind of an odd dichotomy. I mean, you look at the Labor government with ratifying the Kyoto Protocol, and yet they've got a company like Coal Corp, which is exporting coal. It's just weird stuff going down. So the result, you saw it in that graph, the CO2 emissions continue to increase exponentially. So, as Jim said, I was with him on the, as a lead author in the current IPCC report. I saw a lot of this stuff, and my term with the IPCC finished in 2007, and it seemed a natural time, if I was going to make a personal decision and try and do something, to leave NIWA and try and get going. So it was pretty scary. I quit in November 2007, and I'd have to say that the last 2 years have been pretty much a roller coaster. Being self-employed is very, very different to working for an organisation like NIWA. You're very much on your own resources, and it's a bit like being in a feast or a famine situation. You can have so much work on that you just don't know how you're going to manage it, and you have to contract people in to help you, which gets complicated, or there's nothing going on. It's very much swings and roundabouts. So, current carbon emission rates, absolutely huge. If we want to limit warming to 2 degrees C, essentially we've got to stop now. We've got to start right now and cut emissions dramatically. This is going to require massive public buy-in. I just don't see how governments and industry can do this on their own. The public have to be involved. And so that was why, essentially, I figured my major role was going to be education and climate change and renewable energy. And I'll talk later on about why I think renewable energy is so important. So I figured I'd pick a couple of the projects that I worked on, and this is certainly one of the most significant ones in the climate education area. As Jim mentioned, I have a professorship at the Antarctic Research Centre, and through them I was phoned up by Gareth Morgan at home. He said, "Oh, g'day, Dave." That's how he talks. "Yes, Gareth Morgan here, eh? And I think you might be the bloke I need to give me a bit of a hand on this bloody book I've got to write." And he had to write it because his wife told him. bit of background about Gareth Morgan, for those of you who don't know. He's an eccentric economist. He describes himself almost as an anarchist. He and his wife, they're hippies from way back. They lived in a bus, raised their 4 kids in a bus. And they make motorcycle journeys around the world. And on these journeys, they'll go to place UNICEF sites and World Vision sites and essentially give away their son's money. Their son, Sam, it really annoyed Gareth that their son gave them $50 million as their share of selling trademen, because of course the Morgans were already multi-millionaires in their own right, so they decided they had to give all this money away. So anyway, on these motorcycle journeys, they did things like go through the forests, the boreal forests in Canada, and they saw the effects of the pine bark beetle, which are devastating those forests and also other parts of North America, because the winters are so much warmer and the beetles aren't killed off. And this really got to them. They saw a lot of stuff like the sea ice disappearing in the Arctic. So we were put together. I had Lionel Carter, who many of you would know, used to work for NIWA, Peter Barrett, and this strange character over here, formed a team which Gareth immediately started calling me a bandit. He shouts at you, essentially. We became known as Los Banditos. So essentially the nub of what Gareth had to do was this, and it's a question I'd ask you. How does an intelligent layperson get an informed opinion on something as complex as climate change? And let me put it in perspective for you. I'm absolutely addicted to coffee. I just can't handle life without it. I probably drink 3 or 4 very strong cups a day. And you can go to the newspaper, you can read an article like this on how dangerous coffee is, and the same newspaper the next day will tell you what wonderful stuff it is. Now the thing is, I suspect there are no medical doctors here, but here's the issue. You've got two things that are eloquent, they're well written, they look perfectly believable, but how the hell do you tell the difference between them? And that's what's going on with the public and climate change. I'll see an article written by our friend up in Auckland, Jim, which tells you it's a load of nonsense, climate change, and then the next day there'll be an article quoting Jim Renwick, which says that it's full on, we've got to do something. So this is where the public's at, and this is what Gareth Morgan wanted to sort out. So, if you're a layperson and you want to find out about climate change, many of you would go to Google. And if you do that for climate change, I just tried it, 44,100,000 hits. And there's a process known as Google bombing, which some of you may have heard of, where you can use the innate properties of Google, which works by using other sites and links, to get your articles up to the top of the list. So how on earth do you decide what's right and what's wrong? Because many of those articles really look eloquent. They're just like those articles on coffee. Well, here's the process that Gareth Morgan used. He hired two teams of scientists, so he got literally the top climate change skeptics in the world. These include a bloke called Fred Singer, Richard Lindzen, a guy called Lord Monckton III of Benchley. Have you come across this character? So he had quite a lot to do with him, a guy called Keston Green, Bob Carter, and what he referred to as the alarmists. And that's us. That's people who are proponents that something needs to be done about climate change. We're called alarmists because you're raising the in the sense of raising the alarm. And so that was us, the somewhat dubious Los Banditos team. So it was full on. This was months of work last year. Essentially, I had to interactively direct this work with Gareth Morgan on the phone every couple of hours, emails all hours of the day and night, working with his author, John McChrystal, trying to sort this out. It's a pretty unique process. As far as I know, no one else has done this. So, yeah, that's basically what I had to do, was to get involved with providing written critiques of the seminal papers by the skeptics. It was also a hell of a time protecting both Lionel Carter and Peter Barrett from Gareth Morgan, who was pretty belligerent at times. So some of these seminal works, here's one here, and when you look at this, there's a journal known as the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a very well-respected journal in the United States. This whole thing is set up, it's an exact model of a paper from the PNAS, and yet it's absolute nonsense. And so this was one of the works that Gareth gave me. You go through here and there is the most amazing things. And so it was my job to actually critique all of this stuff and then defend that against people like Fred Singer and Bob Carter and so on and so forth. And this is another one, and Jim Renwick's gone white. Because he was involved with this. This was a mere 60 pages, and it took months. There were all sorts of things on cosmic rays, how nonsensical global circulation models are. The oceans, they've covered everything. You can actually buy a copy of this if you want it. So the lessons that we learn from this process, first of all, you've got to be pretty humble if you think you know a lot about climate change. Really, it's too complicated, as I said, for any one person to know about. You've got to really listen to intelligent lay people, try and figure out where they're coming from. The communication on climate change, I think anyone who works in this field is duty-bound to give public talks and try and get this information out in a coherent way. And as a result of this work that we did, Gareth, the Morgan Family Trust, and this is the money from Sam Morgan and TradeMe, they've given us $250,000 just to look at this communication issue. So that's pretty cool. The other thing that Gareth Morgan did once the book was published, he went on a roadshow all over New Zealand, 15 different centres, Heartland, New Zealand, places like New Plymouth and Whangarei and Nelson and so on. And he talked about this book, he talked about climate change, and his message was, we have to do something. The science is still uncertain and need more funding in the science. I'm sure you'd love to hear that. We have to get on. Policy has to move. So this guy, he was pulling in 1,000 to 2,000 people a time in these small centres. Now, Jim Renwick or myself, if you went to New Plymouth, you'd be lucky if you pulled in 30 or 40 people. So this has had an enormous impact on getting the message about climate change out. Just a couple of websites there if you want to look up about the book and about the critiques of the skeptics' work.